Hello, my name is Father Gregory Pine, and welcome back to the Thomistic Institute podcast for an installment of Off-Campus Conversations, where I follow up with a Thomistic Institute speaker on some theme of mutual interest. So for this episode, I am delighted to be joined by Professor Brad Gregory of the University of Notre Dame. Thanks so much for joining.
Thanks for asking me to be here.
So a lot of folks will know you, especially from the Unintended Reformation, which came out now maybe 10, 12 years ago?
Yeah, 2012.
Okay. But perhaps they might know you from interventions that you made at Thomistic Institute campuses or the lectures that have been posted on the TI podcast. But for those who don't know you, could you say a word of introduction, who you are?
Sure. I am a professor of primarily early modern European history at the University of Notre Dame. My interests range widely, and the current project that I'm working on ranges much, much more widely than that. But I'm trained primarily as a scholar of early modern Christianity. I've been at Notre Dame now for 20 years. Before that, I taught for 7 years at Stanford. Proceeded to shock my colleagues after getting tenure there by leaving for South Bend, because the culinary and cultural offerings in South Bend are so much better than the Bay Area. So, no, not really. But anyway, that's a little bit about who I am intellectually, academically, biographically. I'll say more if you want me to, but you know, I'm a cyclist. I have a lot of books. like most scholars. So in any case.
Yep. I hadn't moved into my office up until recently, and I would record something from time to time in this office with my empty shelves. And people would, you know, often be oppressed by that sight. They're like, oh gosh, like what's going on over there? I'd explain simply that I'm illiterate, so I have no need.
Or else so completely absorbed in mystical contemplation that you left behind the mere printed word, yes.
Exactly. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. That's wild. Yeah, you went from Stanford to Notre Dame. I'm sure the Notre Dame folks love to hear that as a preferable place at which you arrived. So I was at Stanford for the first time, and I was kind of astonished by, one, the fact that it's architecturally coherent. Because like you get so used to going to universities and being like, there's a building built in the 30s. There's a building built in the 70s.
Yeah.
But you go to Stanford, it's like, holy smokes, somebody had an idea and they
particularly the main quad. I mean, the main quad is an astounding architectural achievement for, you know, when it was carried out in the last decade of the 19th and very beginning of the 20th century. And they've done a pretty good job making most of the more recent buildings more or less kind of look like they fit in. I think a lot of it has to do also with the, you know, those beautiful sandstone colored foothills behind, and the fact that the sky is always blue. Somehow it just makes everything look more coherent sometimes than it really is. But yes, I mean, if that's what you mean, that the main quad is remarkable, not as is the much commented upon, as you can well imagine, gigantic and unmissable mosaic on the outside of the unmissable gigantic centerpiece chapel on campus of you know, Jesus the Teacher, the huge mosaic there. But in any case, I digress.
Is that also the facade in which features the four principal virtues: faith, hope, love, and charity?
Yeah, exactly. I would point that out to students actually when I was there. I would say, now, what's strange about this quartet? And, you know, ones that kind of knew something would say, well, isn't charity the same as caritas, which is the same as love? I said, yes. So let's talk about why that would have been in the 19th century, because charity had become completely divorced from love, which had become mostly a matter of sentimentality and, you know, contingent affect. Rather than one of the three theological virtues that is originally. But anyway, you know all this.
I don't, but I'm interested. I taught a class here at the House of Studies on theological virtues this past fall. I had taken the course previously, but my training at the doctoral level was in dogma, specifically Christology. And so my students became accustomed to my bewildered face at the beginning of class, because it wasn't like I was teaching from a position of kind of competence or a position of informedness. It was usually like the type of face that one would assume in the midst of a scavenger hunt, having rooted out one clue and anticipating this. I was like, you will not believe what I just found.
Exactly. Let me bring you along on my journey of intellectual discovery. Yes.
Exactly. I can guarantee you that this might be the case. So take it as you will. Okay, so I thought that we could talk about, apropos of the unintended reformation, you've done work in intellectual genealogy. I'm sure there's more appropriate ways to title the project overall, but I'm interested in this fact that, you know, within the scholarly world, but within the human world, we're interested in telling a story of our past as a way by which of making our lives intelligible. I wonder if you could just kind of lead us into the genre, maybe what motivated you to undertake that work, and what have you found in your coordinated study of, you know, history, philosophy, theology, as, you know, fruitful and, you know, delightful in making sense of the kind of human project?
Yeah, that's a huge question and a delightfully open-ended question in its own way. I'll answer it, I guess, with respect to the way in which I tried to use the notion of intellectual genealogy in the Unintended Reformation as a way of trying to characterize the sort of history that I was very self-aware I was writing, which is different from the way in which most professional historians tend to do their work. Let me say a little bit about that first, and then by way of contrast, how what it is that I was trying to do in the book differs from it. Most historians, I mean, professional historians are trained in fairly delimited fields, as we call them. I mean, it's similar in other disciplines, the notion of an academic field. They're not hard and fast, but they tend to be pretty firm, particularly when you're being formed as a graduate student with an eye toward hopeful academic employment, increasingly endangered in many humanistic fields these days. But once upon a time, like when I was a graduate student, you had a reasonable chance of getting an academic job, which means you needed to be trained in a field for the kinds of departments that would have academic job searches that were saying, we are looking for a medieval historian of Western Europe, the year 1000 to 1500, specialized in a certain maybe social or economic or political history, for example. So professional historical fields tend to be delimited by geographic area, by time period, and also by the sort of the type of history. Intellectual history as opposed to economic history, cultural history as opposed to social history, and so forth. And most historical scholarship is done within those fields. So, I mean, it's not that unusual, for example, although it would seem probably bizarre to people in the wider public, for, say, a colonial American historian who is an expert on the lead-in and the early, let's say, unfolding of events, the complexities of the early American Revolution, to say, oh, I don't know anything about the 17th century. I couldn't tell you anything about Puritans, right? I mean, that's not my field, right? That's 17th century stuff. That's way, you know, because and there's a legitimacy to this. There's a huge amount, both of a primary source material that one needs to master in order to get, as it were, up to speed, even to be able to have a possibility of contributing something original or making a high level intervention. And then the amount of scholarship that you have to master as well. So both the primary sources and the secondary material is massive. And historians tend to do their work within that kind of a framework. I am sometimes understood to, you know, be a harsh critic of that per se, or I reject all that. That's not true at all. I love all of it. And I think that what historians do when they do it well is absolutely extraordinary and to be commended. Here's the problem. We're living in a present that is the product of a past that didn't start when social media started. It didn't start when personal computers were invented. It didn't start since the 1960s. It didn't start since 1945. It didn't start since 1914 to 18. It didn't start the American Civil War, the American Revolution. It extends into a distant and a deep past. But if we divide up the past, trying to, say, understand ourselves and our world today, based on the assumption of, oh, well, let's turn to the historians of the modern world, whether we understand that as, say, the 1960s forward or 1945 forward, because they have been handed the baton, as it were, from the historians who are responsible from, say, the world of the late 19th century and the early 20th century, who in turn took had the baton from the historians of the pre-Civil War era in the United States, for example, say back to the early Republic. The problem with that is that you think there's nothing lost when the baton gets held over. You think that all you need to know to understand our contemporary world today is what has transpired in recent years. And the pace of change, the impression is an understandable one, because the pace of change in the world that we experience today is utterly unlike anything before in human history. It's much, much faster than usual. We know this. We experience it. And so that creates the impression that, well, anything, for example, that occurred in the pre-industrial era, I guess maybe that might be of interest to people who like old, really old stuff. Or, and this is a motivation and a you know, it's an issue. I know this from professional historian colleagues, and I share this to some extent myself. A concern to understand the distant past precisely as a sort of drastic contrast with ourselves, how different things are, and the kinds of comparisons and reflections that can generate. But it's not just that the distant past was really different. It's that the distant past, however improbable it might seem, by definition, because we're temporal beings, eventually, and in ways that could never have been anticipated centuries ago, in fact, has given rise to the world that we inhabit today. It's that idea, that recognition, and also some help from some scholars who've been very influential on my thinking in this respect in different areas. Amos Funkenstein, the great historian of science, Alistair McIntyre, who's been a big influence on a lot of people who've thought about genealogical intellectual history and the history of moral philosophy. A couple of thinkers and Max Weber, for example, as well, the notion of the Protestant ethic and ways in which unexpected changes that happened in the distant past are still influencing the present today, albeit not in direct or obvious ways, because the kinds of changes that they effected when they first came about never went away entirely. They were transformed. They became embedded. They became institutionalized. They manifested themselves in a host of different ways, such that those innovations at the time carried forward in ways that have remained extraordinarily influential in the present. That's the idea of genealogy that I was trying to use in the Unintended Reformation. It is that changes that occurred in the same way, for example, same way. It's meant to be pretty closely analogous and envisionable with respect to human genealogy. In the same way that you and I bear the genetic material of our ancestors by definition, right, who lived 500 or 600 years ago, or even further back, we want to go further back. So too, the inheritance, the legacies, the influence, and so forth of changes that occurred in the distant past with respect to the innovation in terms of laws, in terms of metaphysical assumptions, in terms of the way in which an individual is conceived and so forth, with respect to attitudes about the natural world, which have changed drastically over time. In the same way, those kinds of innovations become, as it were, embedded in the cultural, the political, the intellectual, the social flux of human life. So that, what's the upshot? In order to understand ourselves and our world today, how we got to where we are and why our world has the kind of character that it has, we can't simply look at the last 50 or 100 years of change. We can't just look at life even since the Industrial Revolution, which is not to say that the changes haven't been drastic and dramatic. They have, but they're insufficient to account for why we find ourselves where we are. And my point, the key, the central point in the Unintended Reformation was, with this in mind, how is it that we account for a world where we see this combination? Hegemonic, incredibly powerful nation states on the one hand, the entire world except for Antarctica is divided up into sovereign nation states, combined with, in all nations that have in the Western world, certainly, the political protection of individual beliefs and convictions that can be literally anything, what I call in the book, right? We could call it value pluralism. I call it hyperpluralism. People said, what do you mean by hyperpluralism? I mean even more pluralistic than just pluralistic. So, Nietzsche said it was already extraordinarily pluralistic in the late 19th century, but, you know, he didn't live in the early 21st. And if he had, he would have said, wow, this is even more pluralistic than you guys were. So how do we get this combination? Huge open-ended individual preference, basically, on the one hand, combined with inescapable sovereign nation states. The argument in the book is we can't understand those basic characteristics of the modern Western world without understanding the insuperable problems that were wrought by both the doctrinal conflicts never resolved. That's why we have ecumenical relations still going on today between Catholics and Protestants, and the religio-political conflicts of the Reformation era, better known in the popular sphere as the Wars of Religion, or as I call them in my more recent book, Rebel in the Ranks, the Wars of More Than Religion, because religion was more than religion in the medieval and the early modern periods. It was intended and meant to inform all spheres of life. So that's the basic idea. In other words, the structure of the book then is six chapters, each of which focuses on a major domain of human life, whether the interaction among science, religion, metaphysics, chapter one, or truth claims about what people think is true, chapter two, moral views, economic issues, the nature and the places in which knowledge is made and so forth, and traces that from the late Middle Ages through the Reformation era up to the present. The idea being we have a better understanding of how we got to where we are and why we're living in the kind of world that we're living in today if we see it as the long-term unintended response, not coordinated, but heterogeneous, contingent, but nonetheless, without a doubt, heavily influenced by the Reformation era, precisely because Christianity was such a pervasive cultural, social, political influence at the time. I mean, you could not step out of a Christian society in the early 16th century, which means one of the implications was challenges to and rejections of what true Christianity is are bound to have effects in the entire society, the full range of things. And that's exactly what happened. And the modern response to that, broadly speaking, from institutions in terms of separation of church and state to understandings of individual rights, for example, starting with religious freedom, determination of religious belief and practice, those things are the result of the conflicts of and the unresolved disagreements of the Reformation era and attempts to deal with them. And the other, I guess I'll actually stop talking here in a minute, but and you can get a word in edgewise. But the other one of the other ideas in the book is that we can see how these things were in attempt and in important respects successful in dealing with the kinds of problems that were inherited, say, coming out of the Reformation era in the 17th century. In other words, if you have a problem with people disagreeing about what Christian truth is, well, one way to deal with that is to distinguish what had been an understanding of religion that informed politics, economic exchange, and so forth, and restrict it, make religion, in a sense, much narrower in its scope than it was in the Middle Ages and indeed in the Reformation era, where it caused so much disruption. So allow everybody to believe whatever they want to believe. Allow them to worship however they want to. And allow them to engage in whatever sorts of devotional practices. You know, you say your rosary, I'll go to a Bible study. You go on pilgrimage, you know, I'll be in a prayer group or whatever the case may be. In exchange for, you can no longer expect religion to be a socially, economically, politically informative dimension of the society at large. And in a certain sense, it can't be to the extent that people disagree in the ways that they do about it. And of course, if you take it seriously, you disagree about it because you understand that it has eternal implications. It's not just about human flourishing in this life, but God is going to judge you based on the ways in which you have lived, how you've conducted yourself and so forth. So that's a very long and somewhat rambling, but hopefully halfway coherent answer, although not probably as coherent as the core campus of Stanford's architecture. So
no, that's okay. So that's interesting to me. And it's, yeah, motivates a reading of the book, which I suppose is the next logical step. And then we can schedule another episode, which will be a more informed series of questions on the basis of actual engagement. It's at this stage of the game, though, my tendency is to think kind of more meta-narratively insofar as that's helpful. So you mentioned Alistair MacIntyre and specifically his approach to traditions of inquiry. And I'm thinking about his description of practices. And he talked about goods intrinsic to a practice and goods extrinsic to a practice. And then I'm thinking about history, you know, like your work as an historian. And I think about the traps into which people fall, you know, like golden ageism. People have a kind of idealized notion of some past time and they do everything they can to lionize it. Or presentism, you know, they're so immersed in contemporary details that they can't actually conceive of the past except through whatever else, you know, so unwitting. But then there are witting pitfalls into which the historian falls. And I think one of those would be a kind of advocacy. He or she tells the story that need be told in order to advance whatever kind of cause at present. But then my concern there is that what we're doing is pursuing goods extrinsic to the practice. So I guess my question is, with history, like what are the goods intrinsic to the practice that motivate the historian and from which his readers or her readers can profit? Like what, and you can talk about it, you know, in your own case, this particular work, but you can also generalize, like what's at stake and how does that engage a person?
Yeah, it's again, really good question. And one capable of being answered a lot of different ways. The first thing that occurs to me when I think about answering a question like that is, the ways in which, in certain respects, it varies depending on, really, from the get-go, the kind of question or questions that a historian is interested in answering or trying to answer on the basis of reading sources, and material remain, architectural remains, archaeological remains where appropriate, and so forth, or art historical remains, images from the past. The goods intrinsic to a practice in the way that I understand history are trying to pose a question clearly, and then on the basis of any and all relevant evidence, to the extent that that's, you know, humanly possible. In some cases, it's, you know, you can't marshal all relevant evidence. And then all kinds of methodological questions come in terms of sampling and how do you know you've read enough? And what about this case? And so that's all part of, you know, what it is that the historian's craft is about. But in terms of, you know, trying to delimit and to specify a question that you're interested in, you know, how did the distribution of wealth change in the last century of the Roman Republic? A question like that, you've got a subject matter, you've got to understand, here's what I mean by the distribution of wealth. That particular question would be really tricky because the sources are very scattered. You have to, you know, build economic models and so forth. But you've got a time frame, you've got a terminus, and you've got a domain of inquiry, right? And so you can try to delimit and understand what are the kinds of sources that would help me answer this question. The goods intrinsic to the practice are whatever that is. I agree with you in terms of, and I'd never really thought about explicit advocacy history in the terms that you put it, in the MacIntyrean understanding of goods extrinsic to a practice, but I think that's exactly right. Because there, you've already decided what the good is. You've already decided what it is in the present you think is really important to promote. And what you're going to do is you're going to look to the past for whatever confirms, shores up, provides evidence for, strengthens that view. There are historians that do that. Here's the problem with that, though. Almost always, there are other historians interested in the same kinds of things that you are, but without an advocacy point of view. And they also know a lot of the relevant sources that, you know, might not jibe with what it is that you're saying, and so forth. You know, this is a huge problem traditionally with what I would call sort of old-fashioned confessional history, old-fashioned church history, was to a very large extent this kind of history. You knew, here's the truth. We know the truth because the tradition is authoritative. And we look to the past, right, to find those parts. Well, let's say we're Catholic historians. We're going to tell an uplifting, positive story, and where we put together the links of the history of doctrine, the history of church institutions, and so forth, that lead to the present where we know the truth, and the history and the hagiography is going to serve that end. The problem is, of course, there are tons of aspects of the Christian past that just don't align with that very well at all. This is actually, interestingly, one of the unexpected and unintended outcomes of doctrinal conflict in the Reformation era was the advent of recognizably, in a very different context, in a confessionally loaded context, but in that, you know, cut and thrust between Catholics and Protestants, arguing, say, over the period of the early church or the church fathers, they helped give rise to a much more recognizably modern understanding of what the practice of history is, you know. And it doesn't really matter what your, you know, your theology of the Eucharist is per se. You know, good luck finding references to transubstantiation in the first and second, third century, because they're not there. And they're not there for a good reason, because Aristotelian categories weren't used in theology in those centuries as well. So then people will go to, when, you know, so-and-so is talking about the body and blood in this way, and so then you can get into all kinds of those kinds of discussions. But the point is, if you start from what you know to be the case in the present, and you go looking to the past for evidence, you're almost always going to, you're going to run into trouble, because almost always, invariably, you're overlooking certain things. In egregious cases, you're, you know, deliberately kind of like, hey, that doesn't fit. And so you, you know, push it to the side, sweep it under the rug, but other people are going to pick up the rug, and it just won't work out. It won't work out. The best history is history that tries to be as, honest and clear-sighted about the past. And, you know, let's face it, one of our central doctrines is about the, you know, sort of obviousness and absolute need for forgiveness for sins. As I say to my students, you know, Catholicism is an incredibly realistic religion that way. We devote one of our seven sacraments to human sinfulness. So it shouldn't surprise us at all if in the study of the past we find loads of people committing loads of sins, because they did. And we still are. So anyway, that's a little bit about that.
Yeah. Maybe then, to project the study of history into the future, you made passing reference to the kind of demise of the humanities, not the humanities themselves, but interest in funding for academic space allotted to the humanities. And it seems like the way in which some humanities extend their life is by a kind of imperial metricization. You know, it's like, we're not humanities, we're actually science.
Yeah.
And it strikes me that, like, history is one of the humanities that's ineradicably, yeah, I mean, it can go the way of imperial metrics, but it's invested in the telling of stories. It's invested in human genres which defy easy summarization or kind of collapsibility. It's just ineradicably human. So, like, I suppose my question is, in a world which is perhaps losing its grip or losing its appreciation for the humane and the humanistic, what is the historian? How does the historian, as a practitioner of his discipline, do to commend the human and humanizing influence of the subject matter itself, and then the methodological approach? I wish I could ask that question better.
This is another very good question. And that one particularly, it seems to me, that's really where those historians who are particularly adept at rendering accessible the initially opaque, perplexing, inaccessible character of people from the past. It could be the past of the 1970s. It could be the past of the 1270s. And those are very different kinds of people. But when you're reading a great historian who really is able to give us a sense of, you know, the material surroundings, the cultural assumptions, the lived experience of, you know, what it must have been like to live in world X, Y, or Z, that, it seems to me, is a kind of service that historians, specifically historians, because nobody else has the time or the training to even be able to do that. You know, it takes years to be able even to try to do that well. So when historians can do that, they provide a real service to the wider domain of humanistic inquiry. And I think to your broader question about an appreciation for the humane and the human among human beings across time. So that's something that I think is irreducibly historical. It's nobody, if historians don't do it, nobody's going to do it. And if they were to cease to do it, I think something extraordinarily precious and even essentially human would be lost, because we are, there's no way we're getting outside of temporality. Every human being who's ever existed, regardless of time period, cultural context, it doesn't matter. They were temporal beings. They had a certain kind of a social location, and they interacted with their natural environment in certain ways, and they interacted with other human beings in certain ways. All of those things, right, connect us to them. And it's the combination, the recognition of, in certain formal ways, they were very similar to us, but in other respects, they were very different from us. And that is a kind of, I think, endless, there are endless combinations, possibilities, and inquiries that historians can and do make within that pole, that recognition of similarity and difference, that to me is, you know, just, it's just part of being human, to recognize universality and particularity, you know, not to put a too, you know, abstractly philosophical a kind of a label on it, but I think that is part of what's going on there, and that to me seems the combination. We exist in time. You know, there are things that we share, there are things that we don't, and you know, let's try to understand and appreciate some of that variety. It seems to me that's part of what historians contribute to the humane and the humanistic.
Yeah. Maybe just to pursue this a little bit further, I'm thinking still about Alistair MacIntyre in his description of a practice. He describes, you know, like the origin of virtues as those human excellences that need be cultivated in order for one or a community to gain access to those goods intrinsic to a practice. So like if I'm going to experience the delight of playing chess well, then I need to acquire the excellences of good chess playing. Thinking then with respect to history, it, like in the course of the conversation, you've described a handful of different human excellences. So thinking about the gaze that we cast upon the past and acknowledging and in a certain sense pardoning the sins of those who have gone before us. You know, I could see that described as a kind of historical mercy. Or I think about the way that Pope Benedict XVI talks about like intellectual charity, a kind of like sympathy with, generosity towards. You know, there are these various virtues which emerge, which help one to be, you know, like a good historian, so as to tell the story well, rather than getting inordinately exercised at those bad deeds or inordinately severe at the punishment that need be meted out. If you could maybe, yeah, speak to that some more or elaborate on that. What are like the virtues of an historian and how does one become better in this way?
I mean, you ask really good questions. they're fundamental questions for, you know, what it is historians do or try to do. there too, I think, because historians don't do just one thing. And I mean, I've done quite different sorts of things. My first book, which was a revision of my doctoral dissertation, is about martyrdom in the Reformation era. I have a hard time resisting alliterative titles, although Unintended Reformation didn't have a secularized society is a alliterative phrase, but Salvation at Stake is the name of the, and that, and we, yeah, which, you know, again, when I came with that title, I thought that's it, that's gonna be the title. But that book is here, but that book is animated by how do we best try to understand sufficiently the willingness of men and women to die for rival views of Christian truth in the same broad cultural context. And this one also has, I mean, there are a lot of implications of that because, of course, the celebration of Catholic and Protestant and Anabaptist martyrs, respectively, were mutually exclusive, antagonistic, and contributed, back to my point about genealogies earlier on, right, contributed to the formation of the churches and traditions that today people are still talking in ecumenical terms through. So, you know, those two things are connected. But that posed a real, to me, that was the challenge I was after primarily in that book. How do we understand the willingness of people to die for their respective religious convictions? Because they had multiple chances to recant their views. They didn't. They were persuaded. People tried to persuade them and so forth. But of course, you're doing that across confessional lines. You know, if it was just a study of Catholic martyrs or just a study of, you know, Mennonite martyrs, that would be one thing. But you're doing it simultaneously. That means, right, as a historian, you've got to, in a sense, whatever your personal convictions might be, and this was one of the reasons I chose the topic, because I knew if I could pull it off, I would demonstrate that nobody could say, oh, well, Gregory's a Catholic. No wonder he's talking about Thomas More so sympathetically, right, or whatever the case may be. Because, you know, before I outed myself as a Catholic intellectual, nobody knew. People thought I was they thought I was a Mennonite, or they thought I was a Lutheran, or whatever they, you know, guessed. I mean, some very distinguished historians who will remain nameless thought that I must be sympathetic to religion, but couldn't, you know, be any one of those things. And of course, you know, that's not true. But it is true that when you are trying to understand somebody whose views you don't agree with, you can't just impose your views on them, because by definition, then you're not understanding them. So the question, what did it mean to them? What did it mean to them? That was really the question as when I was an undergraduate, that I had a professor who posed that question in class in a very pointed, serious way. And I thought, yeah, that really is what it's about. That's the difference between, I know I've got my moral standards, I've got my criteria, and I'm going to look at the past and I'm going to put people into the black hats and the white hats accordingly. In contrast to, what did it mean to them, regardless of what I think about it, notwithstanding what my judgments or ideas are or whatever. Those are two really different things. Now, that's one kind of doing history. Let's say we've done that, then we're still left with a question. It's a different question. What were the consequences, the outcomes, and the subsequent influences of a world in which people disagreed that I have reconstructed on the basis of my sympathetic understanding of their respective differences, actions toward one another, and so forth? That's essentially the way I approached the way I was doing history genealogically in the Unintended Reformation. They're related. I'm not unsympathetic to the respective protagonists of the past in Unintended Reformation, but that's not the main thrust of the book. The main thrust of the book is be as sympathetic in reconstructing everybody as much as you want. They all are part of this hyper-pluralistic, institutionally contained, modern, liberal, political framework. What does that look like as far as our contemporary ability to specify communities that have shared goods internal to a practice? The answer is disastrous because... Exhibit A is the, you know, kind of almost cartoonishly polarized character of the United States today. That's just one contingent example. There, it's not the only thing that contributed to that, but you know, it definitely feeds into it. There are lots of ways in which that lack of community can play itself out, some more pernicious than others. But so different kinds of history, different sorts of primary questions and animating kind of concerns. What am I after here? Am I primarily after what did it mean to them? That goes back to your previous question about sort of the humane and the humanistic. I think, you know, yeah, let's really get a sense of, you know, what it was like to be, you know, a bishop in fifth century Gaul, or, you know, preaching to his, you know, what was it like for, you know, Caesarius of Arles in the early, you know, sixth century, whatever the case may be. That's a different kind of primary animating question than how did the combination of the last several centuries and all of its complexity, how did that come to its outcome in the world that we know today? Because the past was really different. We know that. That's true. The present is the product of the past. That's also true. And how we get from the one to the other is, in a certain way, is the question. It's about change over time and trying to understand that. And then, well, what does that tell us about ourselves? What does it tell us also about, you know, opportunities and possibilities of going forward?
Okay. For a last question, a kind of lightning round question. When I think about the practice of history as you describe it, you know,
I should say I'm a weirdo. A kind of, I have some pretty, I mean, not a lot of people think about history quite this way. I'm not saying that to put myself on a pedestal or anything, but there are a lot of, you know, some of my colleagues are like, you know, what are you doing? But anyway, go on. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, perfect. So as you describe it, one of the kind of, I suppose, principal fruits of the practice of history is a kind of renewed or deepened appreciation of the interconnectedness of our lives with the lives of those who have gone before us, not just in the sense of like the democracy of the dead, like, yeah, we should honor them, but in the sense that we can appreciate how we are their legacy, or how we are their descendants, whether in flesh and blood or in our social, political, cultural, or otherwise lives. And so, like, I get the impression that the super historian kind of has a gaze upon reality whereby he kind of sees the interconnectedness in the present, but he can also see that interconnectedness extending into the past and have an appreciation for, you know, like the phone that he holds in his hand as not merely, you know, bequeathed to him by Steve Jobs, but as also the fruit of those who lived in the 16th century and those who lived in the 13th. You know, it's like things like that. So maybe if you could speak to one connection that you have unearthed in your study, or one connection that you have discovered in the course of your historical research, where you can see, in a sense, how what we are or what we do at present is downstream of or related to what has gone before us. And anything that you want to choose out of that mess of a question.
Wow. if I wish I knew that question was, you were going to ask that question, because then I could have thought about it for a while. that's really, really interesting. I mean, and I'm just going to, you know, this is relatively random. I hadn't really thought about it, but I'm kind of looking around, you know, those kinds of questions. Sometimes I go to sort of material culture, you know, kinds of things. Right. I mean, so here's this Yeti. You know, those of us of a certain upper middle class income level, right? We like Yeti because they're good. They're dependable. They'll last forever, but they're not cheap. So, you know, this is not so automatically when you're talking about Yeti, you're not talking about something that's accessible to some people in our society, because we live in an incredibly a society marked by shocking cosmic inequalities, among other things, right? But what I'm going to say about this Yeti, though, is it's made out of some kind of aluminum or aluminum alloy. And anything that is made out of metal, out of worked metal, couldn't have existed in any form before the 5th millennium BC. Because that's when metallurgy, the very earliest ancient metallurgy, started. Now, if you were going to, you could write it, and historians of technology do this, right? You can trace the refinement of it and which metals were mastered at what points and techniques. And, oh, when was it, you know, that they could actually cast pig iron in, you know, 18th and 19th century Britain and so forth. But here's what's, again, these are some, you know, ideas that I'm involved with in the current project that I'm working on, because what has struck me deeply about virtually every aspect of our lives, even the ones that I just, you know, offhandedly trace back, you know, 7,000 plus years, is how incredibly recent all of this is compared to what we know about our species now that's been around for, now it looks like at least a little bit over 300,000 years. There are over 10,000 generations, 10,000 generations, not 10,000 years, right? 10,027.5 year generations of human beings, if we count Homo sapiens as human beings, which I think we should, that existed prior to any of the things that we are surrounded by and take for granted. The normal, chronologically, historically speaking, because I, you know, prehistory is just history before we get written sources, so it's all history. And then you could connect that, of course, to, you know, as well we should, in different contexts, you connect that right to the history of evolution of life on the planet and everything else, which, to speak theologically, is all part of God's creation, so we're all good. But the vast majority of human existence in terms of chronology has been lived in one or another form of environmentally connected hunter-gatherers or forager societies. All the stuff around us is super recent. Laws, roads, buildings, writing, language, clothing, in the way that we understand it, certainly textiles, metal. It's all super recent. It's all recent history. Everything, even ancient history, in the normal sense of the word, is incredibly recent. So when you look at and think about our humanness in terms of our hunter-gatherer ancestors, and we're all descended from hunter-gatherers, every one of us. Again, this is that, you know, that human temporality, that connectedness to the human past. It's changed my perspective in lots of ways. And it makes me think, I mean, it has made me reflect in ways that, you know, again, it's a kind of awareness of, and I speak only for myself here, but I suspect lots of people share this because I know I'm not the only one exposed to these influences. Most of us, I think, tend to think about, you know, pre-civilizational, let's say pre-agricultural human beings as sort of, yeah, like borderline human, you know, they were human, but come on, you know, what could they do? I mean, how much technology did they have? You know, how big were the groups that they lived in? I mean, but we know incredible things now, you know, the earliest representational art, now it's back 45, 47,000 years ago, you know, they're making bone flutes 35,000 years ago in Central Europe. So they had music and, you know, they had culture and they had language and, you know, and they, for all their variety and for all their doubtless, you know, shortcomings and problems and challenges, and I'm not saying, you know, all of us given the choice would, oh yeah, I'd rather swap in with, you know, people living from the deer and elk herds in the near the end of the last ice age, but for sure they weren't living on a planet that was threatened by human activity in terms of its anthropogenic influences on, right, the biophysical systems that sustain us all, aka God's creation in our particular corner. I say to my students, yeah, it's all part of God's creation. Yes, I get that. You know, the rings of Saturn and the moons of Jupiter, just as much part of God's creation as our planet. But our planet has a little bit more direct relevance for our lives in terms of God's creation than to any other aspects of, you know, other galaxies and so forth, as awe-inspiring and fantastic as they are. So anyway, I'm kind of giving an expansive sort of multi-stranded answer here. But that's just, I looked over at this Yeti thing. I thought, how am I going to answer this question about, you know, a strand and from the past? But really, we can do this with almost anything, you know? I mean, you know, I see this coffee cup here. So I think about the ways in which archaeologists, really the way in which most dating of periods in the human past before there were written sources is done is through changes in ceramic style. And so when you see in the layers, you know, archaeological layers in a tell, for example, the buildup of sediment that archaeologists study, and there's a change in ceramic style, and then you can trace that in how it was distributed over a certain part of the ancient Near East or whatever. Those kinds of things can be traced back as well. But we still use ceramics today, you know, and bowls and plates and stuff. But there was a time too when, you know, before there was pottery. It's a yesterday invention in terms of, you know. So these kinds of things are very interesting to me. They're all sort of part of the hopper of self-reflection on you know, the human and the humane. And also, I think, incredibly, at least I'm not going to do this work. I'm not qualified to do it. But in theological terms, I think extremely interesting. You know, and if I was trained as an evolutionary biologist or something like that, I think, you know, there's incredibly interesting possibilities here. And some people have done this, you know, this kind of work, the interface of say theology and evolution, because as we know, the alleged conflict between theology and science is a hokey 19th century invention that really has not much to do with anything except mostly anti-Catholicism among 19th century Protestant authors. So in any case.
Yeah. It's interesting. Like, as we kind of come to a conclusion, the relative youth of civilization.
Yeah.
I think about the relative youth of Christianity somewhat often. It's like my grandfather died at the age of 97. If you just string together 20 of his lifetimes, you've got the history of Christianity.
Yeah.
Obviously, it extends in multiple directions, so not to say that you get it. Yep. But, and then I was thinking about this, reading Chesterton again recently in Orthodoxy, where he talks about the youth of God, you know?
Yeah.
Like, whereas we grown-ups grow weary whilst playing child's games, you know, when our niece or nephew says again, says God doesn't grow weary. You know, God says to the sun, the moon, and the stars each day again, and they obey. And obviously, we're using youth there in equivocal terms, but yeah, it's like, There is a sense in which history provides a helpful kind of predisposition for theological reasoning as it concerns like the end times. Like, I think sometimes it's like a kind of historical weariness, which has us, you know, portend ominously that tomorrow holds all, you know, fire and brim. It's just like, we don't know.
that's right. I mean, I'll just leave it there. Otherwise, I'll go on for another 10 minutes.
and I'd be delighted at the prospect. But yeah, maybe I can read Unintended Reformation, and then I can email you again in a few months.
All right.
So thank you. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Oh,
if folks
pleasure.
Want to follow up with you and with your work, where they just find you on the internet?
Yeah. I'm through the history department at Notre Dame.
Wonderful. All right. Thanks so much. Turning to you, the listener, thanks so much for tuning into this episode of OcFamous Conversations. If you haven't yet, you can subscribe on YouTube or your podcast app, and you'll get updates when further things come forth. Know of our prayers for you. Please pray for us, and we'll look forward to chatting with you next time on the Thomistic Institute podcast.